Okay, thank you very much for inviting me. I'd like to talk about conformal filtering in embedding space. It's work I've done with Whittold from Yale. It's been my longtime collaborator on all this. And then there's my group with Valentina and Wenji, and his group with Alex and Jingpin. So I'm going to talk about conformal field theory, and obviously, but from the point of view of embedding space. And you know, usually with the bootstrap, what you want to get are the blocks and then bootstrap them. And what we wanted to do was to kind of take a step back from the beginning and go to the operator product expansions then. So we all know that if we have the three-point function or the operator product expansion, the OPE, we basically have the same information. However, we felt that if we could get the operator product expansion and get it in a useful, convenient way, then we could get to higher point function using it. Because it's not always easy to go from a three-point function to a four-point function from the just from the correlation function. But technically, if you have the OPE, which I'll write like this for now, and I'll explain as I go. If you have the OPE, you can use it in the m-point correlation function and write the m-point correlation function in terms of the m-1 point correlation function. And since we know that like the two-point functions are kind of trivial, or if you want, there's only one one-point function, then we could go and start from an eight-point function and go all the way down to a one-point function and be done with the result. So everything would be written in terms of the OPE coefficients that we have there, and actions of differential operators on some function. Okay, so I guess one thing I must say, like I'm using the notation of Ferrara and collaborators from the 70s. So my coordinates in embedding space are called etas. And I think that like in the new way of doing that, people usually use X or my capital X or capital P. So I'm sorry for that. Eta is a coordinate in embedding space. It is not the metric, okay? Okay, and just to let you know what we can get, so from this, we can get blocks. Obviously, that's what we're looking at. So if we look for the blocks of L E1 and 0, 0, 0, 0 four-point function, then they are proportional to this object here. So it's the Gegenbauer in D dimension with the index x L here of x, on which I do some substitution. The variable x is defined like this, x4 minus alpha 3, alpha 2, 3 over 2. And x3 and x4, it's just they come from somewhere else. That's why they are called like this. But you could just think of this one as being this, and this one is 1 over u. No, it's just u. And then the substitution you have to do is you take this Gegenbauer polynomial, you expand it, then like you'll get a bunch of x to a given power. So you expand this stuff also. And then you get powers of alpha 2s, I'll call S2, alpha 3 S3, alpha 4 S4, X3 to, I'll call it R3 and X4 to the R4. And you do the substitution that when you get this thing.
Sorry.
Yep.
Before you write all this formula, I'm already a little bit lost. What is the logic? What are you doing here?
I'll get to that. That'd be the main point of the talk. Now I'm just giving an example. So I do expect that it's completely coming from nowhere, because it is coming from nowhere at this point. But as I go through the talk, I hope it's going to get clear. So what I'm doing, like, is basically just telling you, after a lot of work, that is an answer. And I just want to, like, point out how it looks like. And then I call this x3 over x4. So this is the extend g function. Okay, so not well written, but whatever. So the point is, we can compute blocks, and we can get them written this way. So there will be linear combinations of Gegenbauer polynomials with some prefactors of this variable x. And then when you expand everything, this guy will give you a bunch of sums with, like, powers of with alpha 2s, alpha 3s, alpha 4s, x3 and x4 to given powers. And then I'm telling you, change those guys by some constant that depends on those parameters, some powers that depends on those parameters, like the s and the r's, and some extend g function that depends also on those parameters, and you're done. You have the block. And that works for any spinning conformal correlators. Okay.
Can you say more about the alphas? How should I think of them?
It's just like placeholders to make the substitution there.
And there'll be a substitution shortly.
Yeah, but actually, no, it's all in there. So, like, I would do it if I wanted to, but, like, I don't want.
So x3 and x4 are cross ratios. What are alphas?
Alphas, okay, like, where they come from, they come from the embedding space coordinate. So it's basically at a 4 here, at a 2, and at a 3, and at a 2.
Again. Okay.
Basically, that's what they are. It's just like, in the usual case, you would have indices on those, and now I kind of got rid of those indices. But I wanted to keep the information which type of eta indices they were.
Oh, I see. So you write something in terms of alphas, and then you apply this substitution.
Yeah, rule. Yeah, exactly. Okay. And then you're done, there's nothing else.
Okay.
So everything at the end is written in terms of conformal cross ratios. And for more complicated cases, you will have, like, the etas appearing there. Like, you have everything here. So this is a finite sum because it's a Gegenbauer. And this, like, will be to a power. The highest power is related by, like, is given by those guys. And so you just do a binomial expansion. So it's a finite sum. And everything is written in terms of the extend g function, which is the d-dimensional scalar block, if you want. So all the answers are written in terms of this guy. Is that good? OK. Yep.
Oh, this is a microphone. So you get an expansion, like, you get an expression for general spin conformed block as a sum of scalar conformed blocks.
Yep.
And so, okay, you get the same expressions as like Dolan-Nossburn.
Yeah, obviously, like, if we checked, and if you check that they match, yeah, it's okay. The same thing. So, like, we checked all the examples we did with what was on the literature. So in some cases, for example, this one, which is the classic one, it's well known. But other ones, you have to take derivatives on them. So we just checked the lowest order. We didn't generate everything. In our case, everything that you get is just a sum, like, of those extend g functions. So there are no derivatives to take. Everything is done. Is that good with that? Yep. Okay, so basically that's the goal. It's starting, like, taking a step back, going to the OP, and then going forward after that. And as we worked on that, we kind of figured out that actually the OP that we'll get is very powerful because we can go to M point correction function, so higher point correction function. Okay, so I'll talk a bit about the different ingredients that we need here. And the problem with all this is, compared to everything that's in the literature, there's point zero. It's the same one than what is known, so the embedding space. And then after that, point one is different. So because of that, I do expect a lot of questions. And it doesn't bother me, like just go ahead and ask me questions. Okay, just like quickly. And by the way, it works in any signature, but I will stick to Lorentzian signature here to make it simpler. So okay, I'm pretty sure that everybody knows if you take the Lorentz group, you extend it with the Poincaré group, you add dilatations, and you add special conformal transformations, you get SO2D. So that's the embedding space. It goes all the way back to Dirac. And you would like, but there, like your algebra is homogeneous. You take your coordinates in position space, and you go to embedding space. But you live on some hypercomb. So you have a square equals to zero. And a lot of work was done in the 70s on that by Ferrara and all. And the way to link them is something like this. So I added two points, two directions, d plus 1 and d plus 2. And I take my position, my coordinate position space related to the coordinate and embedding space. OK. So that part is the same. Now it's over. first difference. Actually, like at this point, it's just always different. So for that, I'm sorry. It's going to be hard to explain. It's when you want to uplift. So you would take like an operator, and you'd like to send it to. I'll put x here to say it's in position space. You would like to send it to an operator in embedding space. So here it's position space, and here it's embedding space. And that people have worked a lot on that. But if you just look at how it's done, it's kind of not universal. So if you take bosons, they're not too bad. But the way it's done, it's different than the fermions. And here, if you have self-dual or self-dual ones, it's also different. So, like, there are reviews on that. Like, Weinberg had a clear two papers where, like, that was clear from the first to the second. That everything is weird there. The connection is not easy. And from the first one, there was something different here also. So we're gonna have to try to do something about that. To treat everything the same way. So treat all the representations exactly the same way. And for that, I have to introduce a lot of stuff. OK. So first of all, what we'll do is instead of using operators with vector indices, we'll build them out of products of spinor representations. So with the spinor representations, and I'll stay here in odd dimensions because there's only one spinor, so it's simpler. It works for I'm going to stay in odd dimensions because there's only one spinor, and even dimensions, they're more, so they're two. But it works in even dimensions also. It's just for simplicity. So you have a Clifford algebra, and you get the representation, the matrix for the vector representation, the spinor representation given by this. So that's trivial. And then you have a full algebra on the operators in position space. Like this, you get x mu d nu, x nu d nu. So this bit everybody's fine with. There's no issue. Like this. I put the I here, and there's no point putting an I here. Okay, so, and then you have the other guides. So translation, dilatation, and special conformal transformation. And the point is, this guy, if I include the spinner indices on it, but like each spinner index will rotate with one matrix like this. The other ones don't rotate, it's just like each time you have one, but not on the other. So basically, just the expansion of the exponential. Okay. So here, that could be in an irreducible representation that I will denote by n. And that's the set of Dynkin indices here. So if n1 is equal to 1, it's a vector. If it's a bunch of zeros, a scalar. And 2 is equal to 1, it's a two-index anti-symmetric guy. And 1 is equal to 2, it's a two-index symmetric traceless guy. And r is equal to 1 is a spinner. And r is equal to 2 is a self-dual, is a anti-symmetric with the rank, the number of indices, which is rigid. So that should be fine. And then I'll define a couple of quantities like this to I to r minus 1. So n here is the number of spinner indices I will get on my operator. So for each of them, let's say it's a vector representation. So I have a 1 and a bunch of zeros. I have 2 indices on my operator. It transforms like the gamma matrix, if you want. I have 2 spinner indices on it. But if it's n2 equal to 1, and all the other ones are equal to 0, it transforms like an anti-symmetric guy. But again, like it's gamma mu times gamma nu anti-symmetrized. So it still has 2, there's a question there. It still has 2 spinner indices. And if it transforms like a spinner, then you would just have one.
Can I just say something?
Yep.
Look, this talk is not going in the right direction because we cannot absorb all your notation. If you want to convince us that your ideas have anything interesting in them, why don't you just consider the simplest possible case? Show us something beautiful. I mean, we know how to generalize everything to something.
Yeah, like, okay.
The most complicated. Just convince us that there is something in what you have to say. Apart from notation. Okay.
Yeah, so that, like at the beginning, I put something that was quite clear, I think. But
no, it was not very clear. You said you were not going to explain. This is something which is coming out of nowhere. You said it yourself.
But
now it's more stuff coming out of nowhere. Just
no, actually, it's all in the papers. So it's not coming out of nowhere. But
look, we are 20 minutes into the talk. You have to say something concrete, not just some notation.
I am saying something concrete, but I don't think, like, I am not. I'm just putting stuff in order because we're doing it for all representations. So because of that, I have no choice. I have to talk about representations.
Just tell us about some simple representation we know how to generalize. We are not imbeciles.
But that's why I'm talking about the examples here. For example, like if I put n1 equal to 1, it's a vector. And 2 is equal to 1 is a 2-index anti-symmetric guy, and 3 would be a 3-index anti-symmetric guy, et cetera, et cetera. So I know that most of the time people are used to play with four scalars in the four-point correction function, but we're doing it for all the representations. So because of that, I do have to introduce Lorentz irreducible representations of the Lorentz group. So I know, like, actually at this point here, I didn't do anything, I'm still in position space. So I'm just describing like operator with spinner indices. There's nothing else than that. The only thing I'm saying is like it's going to transform the proper way, and I have to kind
okay,
of symmetrize
okay, let me,
this.
Okay, I don't want to stop you from your talk. Let me just say, don't be offended if in 10 minutes nothing is happening. If it's just notation, don't be offended if I just stand up and leave. Okay?
that's fine with me.
No.
So, like, people want to leave already?
No, we don't want to.
Just like to understand things more conceptually. That's what we're trying to get.
So here, if you want, I can go very conceptually, but please ask questions that will help a lot where it's not clear. So
What is the idea? What is the idea? What is new with respect to what that was in the 70s and what with respect to the techniques?
The idea is to uplift the operators in a general way. So, not making a difference between bosons and fermions, not making a difference between normal bosons and self-dual, anti-self-dual ones, and doing it for any representation, including the mixed representation, so like where you have a bunch of stuff there. Yep.
I understand that you want to do things generally, but it's no news being able to do things for general representations. Like, there are many methods of doing that, and I believe that you're not just doing, like, the thing that you're doing is not just coming up with some notation for general representations, so.
Why don't we let it go on, come on, just let it go on.
Yeah, I'm just trying to say that, can you maybe explain what happens next? Maybe you can explain, like, how do you derive that formula that you showed in the beginning, and then you can say how this generalizes to more general case, because. Like, how do you get this formula that you showed in the beginning, in the simplest case, and then you can explain how to generalize
it? That's exactly what I'm doing, but I do have to introduce stuff. I'm sorry, because if I don't,
please go on.
It's going to be hard. So, like, here, what I want people to understand is those are Dynkian indices for the representation. There's nothing else than that. And I don't know if you're used to play with, like, larger representations, but if I were to put like 3, 2, and 1, let's say, it would have 3 indices that are symmetrized, 2 indices that are, 4 indices that are anti-symmetrized by pairs and symmetrized between each other, and then 1 set of 3 indices that are anti-symmetrized where I subtract all the traces. It's just to know what I'm talking about, because otherwise it wouldn't be possible. Like at this point, if you want, I'll go to embedding space, so you'll see how it works when I go there. So going to embedding space, we'll end up having Galois matrices. And generators and the spinner representation. Like this. And I have to give you what they are. But I don't want to spend too much time on this. So like, we have the other one, so you can construct all this. And now you would like to ask yourself, like, how is the algebra? How does it go on the other side? So you would like to see if you can write the equivalent here. So those are all the SO2D generators. And then I have an operator in embedding space. And can I get this? So the usual thing in embedding space. Can I get this? And how can I get this? So how can I make it work in the embedding space? So the point here is the same point than usual. You use the consistency conditions, the homogeneity one, and the transversality one. So that doesn't change. It's the same thing than the usual. But if you look at defining representation, so like homogeneity is basically this on the operator. And it must be this. But my twist is different than the usual twist, because it's the spinner that I had, the spin number that I had introduced before. So basically, it's 1/2 the number of spinner indices I have on my operator. So that's what I need here. And then there's transversality. is equal to zero. Yeah. And that implies that if I look at the spinner, I have that there's one guy here, the first half that I call it plus, and then I have the part that I would call minus that is given by this. So it is related to the plus part. And so for a spinner, here's a spin one half. That's clear that that's the same thing than usual. But when you do it for a vector, for example, in this case, like here, I would have one index. And vector, I would have two indices. And then I get a matrix with plus plus, or plus minus, or minus plus, and on minus minus, where you can relate all the terms like those here, they're all related to this one with gamma matrices in front. OK. So if you want to get this, the algebra in embedding space and everything works, you basically have to project on the first half of the operators. So you just keep this bit, but you do it for all indices. So you project on the first half for each of them. So here you would do this. And here you would kill this guy, you would kill this guy, you kill this guy, and you would kill this guy. And then if you do that, you do get the proper algebra. Okay? So at this point, everything is fine. So it's slightly different because of the spinner indices, but the rest is the same. That's fine? Is there questions on that? That's not too bad. Are you getting something out of it?
No.
OK. So
what's the main idea?
I'm just trying to uplift the operators from position space to embedding space in a unified way. So like, let me cut that short.
Are you going to use spinners for everything?
Yes, I will use spinners for everything. I'm using spinner indices for everything. But I'll cut that short because like it's not going anywhere with this. So I'll just like say how it works. Because clearly, I was just trying to make it clear. But I agree, there's a lot of stuff. So it's not easy to make it clear. So OK. Let's do it. Yeah. I've been thinking about how to give this talk for a bit, and it's clearly hard. So OK, let's say I'm in position space. OK? What I'm going to say is the following. If I take a defining representation, an EI, so it's a spin one, a vector, a spin two index by two index anti-symmetric, three index anti-symmetric, et cetera, et cetera. It goes to embedding space with spinner indices to this. Okay? So I start from a vector and I get a two index anti-symmetric guy in embedding space. That's different than the usual uplift. Is that okay? The position of the non this is the usual vector, so and then I would write like this.
In embedding space, the algebra is one rank higher, and this map between like that you shift all the indices to the right by one is completely centered, and that's what always happens.
What I'm saying is usually when you take a vector, it goes to a vector in embedding space.
Okay.
So me, it's going from a vector to a two-index anti-symmetric guy.
Okay.
So that is different. So in the general thing, you would start from n1, n2, et cetera, like to nr. And it goes to 0, and 1, and 2, and R. That's good.
Yes, so that's good. I'm just saying this is not really different. We can talk about this, but this is just a formulation of what's usually done.
But usually you would start with an operator that has one index, and then you would go to an operator with one index in embedding space. But I'm kind of saying that you
have... So if you have two asymmetric indices, you also have embedding space coordinate eta, you can contract it with one of the indices and you'll get...
Yeah. So, okay, that I agree. Like, it's basically just transversality again. Okay. So, so this step is okay. However, there is an issue because for the defining representation, there's no issue going from here to there. But when you take a mixed representation, I can see it as products of two. Let's say I take a spin two symmetric traces. I would take an E1 times an E1 here. That's fine. And then I go and pick up the two E1 inside the product. That's OK. But on this side, if I take an E1 plus E2 times E2, and I pick up the two E2 inside, there is a problem with the traces, because the traces on this side, the trace in position space has it's just a value d, but on this side the value is d plus 2. So I cannot subtract the traces straightforwardly. I have to introduce a new metric. And that is done very simply, actually. So what you have to do is the following. You take your metric in position space, and I will use also the same notation. Then my notes. Where did I put that? Right here. Okay. D and gamma mu 1 mu n. And you go to embedding space by introducing a new metric that depends on two coordinates. And that metric has come up before. Like this. This one I define an epsilon. Put it up so it follows AD, which is defined like this. So I'm not sure if it's useful to write this. Actually, it's probably not. So. But this one is interesting, so I'll put it. And then like a bunch of A's, D, AD. And this one is just gamma 1 2, gamma 1 2 a nu, a n, which is gamma with indices a 1 to a n prime, followed by also a 1 2, a 1 prime, a 1, and the other ones. Okay, so contrary to, so this step was kind of known, but contrary to the usual, the epsilon tensor goes from some object with d indices to some object with d indices also. Okay, so because of that, we are fine with respect to all the identities related to the epsilon tensor in embedding space. And the gamma matrix is simply the gamma matrix you would have in embedding space, but multiplied by a bunch of A matrix. Sorry?
What is 1 and 2 here?
Ah, OK, so that I have to go back to this. So when the embedding is done like this, I have my OP. And the point is to lift that to embedding space.
So these are the coordinates of the two operators in the OP.
So yes, they are exactly this. So there are the two indices that appear here, the two coordinates that appear here, I should say. So the OP has two embedding space coordinates by definition. And those two coordinates appear in all the redefinitions. So what you would have in position space, you just take it and replace the stuff by this, and then you get the stuff in embedding space. Okay. Okay. So now, like, we kind of managed to uplift the operators to embedding space. So what we have to do is find the differential operator that is here. And that's not easy. How much time do I have? Yeah. I'll go in general terms. So this differential operator is not easy to get. So I'm sure you all know of the differential operators that are well defined on the light cone in embedding space. So you have the homogeneity operator, like this. You have the one for Lorentz. So dB minus dA. And you have the Thomas Todorov one, which I don't remember. Okay, I probably have it here. But I just write Thomas Todorov. Everybody knows. So you have those three differential operators that are well defined on the light cone for one point. And the point is, if you go to two points, you can prove that all the three differential operators here, actually not this one, this one goes with the homogeneity condition, so it doesn't generate descendants. So we can forget about this one. And we care about those two. And you can show that those two are can be computed from this guy here. Where is it? Oh, yeah, here. Index A. So I have some normalization here. I have the metric that is there. And I have a derivative with index B. OK? So we have the metric appearing, the differential operator at 2, and some prefactor that we don't care. It's just for normalization. It's a nice one for homogeneity properties. And obviously, the differential operator that is here should act at 2, because I chose my operator on this side to be at 0.2. So I have this differential operator. And from this one, I can get those. But I had to introduce an extra point. So that might seem weird, but we can get back to that. So basically, I can write this one and this one in terms of linear function of those guys. OK? OK, so that means there's a unique differential operator for the OPE. And then technically, you're done. So you could put that differential operator in there and get your OPE. However, it's not a nice OPE because you cannot compute much with it. So you have to generalize it a bit by taking linear combinations of this one. So this one, and this one squared, which is basically just this one that you square. And this guy here was found by Ferrara and collaborators in the 70s. And then you use the consistency condition to find what are the powers that you need for the differential operator. This one is a scalar differential operator, so I can lift it to a power that is not a real number, like it's not an integer number. Okay? It could be a negative number, it could be like minus 3.1. Actually, it's going to depend on the conformal dimensions.
Can you actually explain how do you define this operator to an integer power? What is the proper definition?
You mean what is the definition?
Yeah, when you raise an operator to a fractional power, how do you define this?
So okay, this bit is all into how it acts. So you have to look at how it acts on cross ratios, for example, to see how you define it. And you define it by looking at region. So you know, like for the extend g function, for example, at q and v, if you look at the u equal to 0 and v equal to 1, it's equal to 1. So in that limit, you can look what how you can define this guide to a fractional power. So when you find that, after that, you construct the blocks, if you want.
But can you have an intrinsic definition? I mean, like, I know what a derivative is. So I know how to act with it on anything, not necessarily this function or some other function. So is there an intrinsic definition of how you
by,
use it?
You know, technically, you would one thing you could do is you look for an integer power, you look how it acts, and then the function that you get, you just change that power to a given number and then hope that it's the right one. So the hope part, it's a lot of work, but it's doable.
That's
like a fractional derivative. Yeah, it's a fractional derivative. But there's a hope part, and that's all finding the right analytical behavior, and that was hard. So I'm not going to get into details because it's very complicated. But like you do get the right one, so you can check that it is the one that you would like to have. So using a differential operator built out of this one and fractional powers of this one, I can get this differential operator here explicitly. But what is nice is okay. So let me check this. I'll put some stuff here, like but. So that would be the sum over the operators, and here the tensor structures. So you have this. You would have a tensor structure appearing here. So the OPE coefficient is here, OPE coefficient. This is a tensor structure. And then you have the differential operator. And the differential operator would be, in this case, would be no, that's OK. It would be the differential operator that I have here. Morally, this one at 1, 2, but then it's at a given power h, and also well, okay. Like I'll put those first to a n, and then differential operator to a given power h. I think I used 2 h in my notation, but whatever. On this here. And what's interesting now is the differential operator that you have here, this guy, if I were to build it just out of this one, it would be some mess. But built out of the proper combination, it's symmetric traceless. So being symmetric simplifies a lot. We'll be able to know how to generalize the scalar case to the spinner case. And another property that it has is the following. So if I have all those differential operators, and it acts on eta 2s only, it doesn't act on anything else. okay, it acts on the cross ratios also. But in the case I'm interested in here, it acts on the right still, okay? So it acts on extra functions, but in the most general case, I will have spinner indices that are left from whatever I get when I compute correlation function. So those k eta 2s here, I can commute them true, but I have to know what is the commutational relation, and what I get is basically the following. I can just rewrite it as this, with like a proper h on the right compared to the h on the left. So what it means that the differential operator that I have here, that had some free indices coming from the fact that it's acting on some operators and some representations, so there are spinning indices. when I employ that in a higher point function, I get a bunch of stuff coming out from there, and I have free eta 2 indices that are not maybe that are not contracted. So those guys, the eta 2s, technically I'm in trouble, but because the differential operator is well made, I can commute them on the other side and just rewrite it this way. So it becomes the same differential operator than before, but n is shifted by n by plus k. So if I know how this acts on cross ratios, then I know everything. Okay? So that's the point behind all that. And that bit we've done, and that's the part with the fractional derivative. And that's not easy. So I'm sorry for introducing all this stuff, but I kind of have no choice. I'm trying to not to give the idea, the general idea. But there is a lot of stuff. So I'm very sorry for that. Is it better? Not clear. It's too much stuff. Yeah, okay, so I'll go very very simply from now on. So I will call this differential operator just D for now. Okay.
Sorry, we'll just try to summarize and then we can
make a okay, so, I can do that.
Yeah. So when you have two, so suppose we want to compute 4-point function of something with spin.
Yeah.
You say this OP is going to act on some 3-point function with spin.
Yeah.
And this is like a scalar function times a bunch of polynomial stuff. And you say the first step is you commute all this polynomial stuff across.
Yeah.
So now you act on the
scalar part. Just to make that clear.
So you use some commutation relation that you've worked out. But then you still have an infinite sum to do, right? It's not this fraction. Does this fractional derivative thing give you directly a block?
Or? Yes, it does.
Ah, okay. So at the end, are you going to have a finite sum?
Yes. Or, okay. Like we had at the beginning. So let's go through that to make that clear. And tell me if it's not clear. So I'll re-explain. So let's say you do this. You would have like that sum, like whatever, with the different operators and the tensor structures associated to it, the OP coefficients for it. So it would be a sum over M now that I use K. And then I would have the differential operator, IJM, at eta 1, eta 2, on some like 3-point function, M, eta 2, K, eta 3, and L, eta 4. So that's okay. But this guy will be like some sum of bunch of eta 2s, bunch of eta 3s, bunch of eta 4s that are not contracted with some powers here of the contracted stuff. So those are all powers that we don't care. Okay. And now what I'm saying is those guys with the derivative doesn't matter. But those do. However, when I commute them, what I do is I get from this derivative to basically the same derivative. So it becomes like, I'll put a hat on it. But it becomes the same thing. So I have this. With different powers, whatever. Okay, so at this point, this all goes true. The eta 1, 2, that derivative is made such that it commutes with the eta 1, 2, so you take it out. So you're just left with acting on this. So you have some powers of eta 2, 3, and some powers of eta 1, 3. And the point is, okay, what is that derivative? So I'll just say that if you have the derivative in D dimension with some power that the H I had, and I shift it with the number of spinner indices, whatever. It's not that important like this. So that would be if you want A1 to AN, including the K then before. We can forget about this. And then like you get eta 2, 3 to a given power, and eta 1, 3 to a given power. So basically now you just have to act on this. Actually this one goes through also.
Yeah, instead of the following basic question, so this sum is an infinite sum, like the OPE is a sum of
No. This sum here is not, it's a 3-point function.
Well, the sum on the left,
yeah.
It's infinite.
Yeah.
Is there a point where somehow this infinity get removed, or?
Yes, because in that three-point function, not all operators appear. So only the exchange one will appear. Yeah, but that's a four-point function. So it's a four-point function. You sum over all the sum, no.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a four-point function, so here the sum keeps going up.
Okay.
So if you want, like, let's say it's two scalars, you would have spinel exchange here.
But if you look at the single block, you get a finite sum or an infinite sum?
I get the block, which is an infinite sum, but I get just one block. So it's a finite sum, if you see what I mean.
Your expression for a block is going to be expressed in finite
sum? Yeah, finite sums of gx10, and gx10 are infinite. That's good? Okay, so now, like, the question is just how does that act here? Nobody told me anything here. It's 2, 3, 3, 4, and 2, 4 that I should have. So actually, this all comes out of the derivative because of that, they're at 2. And then I'm left with a power of 2, 4, and a power of 2, 3 here. Okay. So the point here is this guy is symmetric traceless. Traceless with respect to the embedding space metric, so the GAB, but it's symmetric. So basically, a lot of work allows you to write this as some sum of like a symmetric function. I'll just call it S for now. I'll go back to it. And then like extend G's basically. Extend G functions of U and V. I'll make it simple. And this here is symmetric with like, let's say a Q1 eta 1, Q0, G0, Q2 eta 2, Q3 eta 3, and Q4 eta 4. So you just like put indices on those, A1 to AN, and you symmetrize the whole thing, okay? So that's a very simple object, and then I get the block there. So because of that, this goes and acts on those, and they're replaced by this function that is a sum of extant G function with some dependence on the spin indices in front here. So all the spin is now here. And I get the sum over m, which is infinite, the sum over a, that is finite, for each m. It goes from 1 to the number of tensor structures for like this three-point function. And then like I get whichever terms I have from the three-point function here. Is that OK? Yep. OK. So with all this, again, I'm sorry for introducing all this stuff. But with all this, now we have the proper way of applying the differential operator. So I can just write the three-point function and apply the differential operator by simply saying, okay, like the differential operator acting on this is that function. So I don't have to do derivatives anymore. So what I get is some kind of substitution. And that goes back to the very beginning. I get substitutions to do on some sums that like represent a three-point function. And the substitution introduces a block. So let me check. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the best way is here. Okay. So let me just this is what I want. Okay. So what I get is I get some stuff with spins here related to the spins that I have here, and that is fixed. I get some powers of eta 1 2s, etc. And basically that's more or less fixed by homogeneity. And then I get a sum over the exchange operator. So those would be the blocks. The tensor structures if you want the tensor structures, would be the tensor structures from the four-point function, the ones from the three-point function. And then I have a block. Before I have the OPE coefficients, M and K L M. And then I have the block. So of U and V. And this guy should depend on A and B, because we all know that they depend on which tensor structure you're looking at. And the block, I can write them basically like, I'll just do the scalar case to make it clear. And I explain what the heck I mean by this. Four, three, four, okay. So it's more or less what I get. So let me explain the steps. Here I have the projection operator. It's the projection operator for the representation I have here. So the exchange operator has a representation, let's say n, so some n Dedekind indices. It's group theory, you have to find that guy. Once you have that guy in position space, you do the substitution that I mentioned. You take the G, you send it to A. You take the epsilon, you send it to epsilon 1, 2. And in this case, epsilon 2, 4. And then you take the gamma and you change it by the capital gamma 2, 4. You do that for all of them. You multiply those two guys, and then you do the conformal substitution for the three-point function. So that's basically like here. Yeah, I forgot my tensor structures, sorry. So this is a conformal substitution I would do if I were to do a three-point function. I have a conformal substitution. I know how the differential operator acts, so it's easy. But once I have this, I multiply by those two. And on this, I do the conformal substitution for that I just mentioned. Okay, so I know, again, how the differential operator acts. I just do it. Once I have this guy, I can multiply by the tensor structures on both sides, and I end up having the block. Okay. So that's how you get the block. And going back to the example I had before, you can do it by, because the conformal substitution 4, if you remember, my last OPE was done here. Oops. It's at 1, 2. And those guys are built from objects at 3, 4, while those are built by objects at 1, 2. So this guy can go in, and this is basically my three-point function. So you can use the three-point function, the usual stuff, multiply by this, and do the conformal substitution with the differential operator, and you get the block. And if you do it, for example, for scalars, you know that this three-point function is scalar-scalar with spin L exchange. So there would be a L dependence here. And then, being the spin L exchange, you have the projection operator for the spin L. It's the guy that is exchanged. But I multiply the answer by those. And then I do the conformal substitution 4. And what we get is, like, in this case, there's only one in each, is that you can write it, at least, like, yeah, it doesn't matter, like this, with a substitution that comes from this here. So basically this step. So now, to make it clear again, at least I hope, is I have a finite sum because it's again bar. This thing has four terms in it, the alphas I mentioned before. So you do binomial expansion on it. You would get three binomials from this one. So I end up with four sums. And then for each of them, I do the conformal substitution that I need. And I get four sums of GXTEN, which is exactly the result by Donald and Osborne. And the thing is, we can do it for any representation. So we can get spinning blocks without too much trouble. So let me recap. Basically, what we did is start from embedding space using spinner indices instead, building the representations this way, finding the proper way of uplifting that to embedding space, Once that's done, that implies substitutions of metrics, epsilon tensors, gamma matrices. Then you have to construct the differential operator. There is only one that's well defined with two points. It's the unique one. You can construct all the other ones from that one. You find the proper way of putting all that together such that the differential operator acts in a way you can compute. You compute that way, and it works. Like I've done it for 3 and 4 point functions. It works for m point functions. So we have the proper analytic behavior for m point functions. And once you have that, you look at an OPE, at a correction function, whichever, and use the OPE several times until you get to 2 point functions where you know the answer. And you get everything. So you get the answer in terms of a bunch of sums, obviously, over the tensor structures and all. And you use the properties of all the functions that we derived to get the blocks. So in the case of 4 point correction functions, there's only one substitute by two substitutions, but the 3 point one is kind of trivial. So there's only one hard substitution to do. And really, like, that's done. So if you want, the conformal part is done. What is not done is the group theory part. So building the projection operators and building the tensor structures. So that basically what I'm saying is, to do the conformal bootstrap, we just have to do group theory now. In a way, that's what I'm saying. So I think, to get the blocks. So after that, you also there's a lot of work, but yeah. So I would stop here.
Thanks. Can you just clarify? So I'm not very familiar with X and G function. So X and G function is just literally the scalar block.
Yeah, it's the scalar block. So basically, you get all the blocks in terms of the scalar block.
But for scalar exchange also?
It's scalar exchange with four scalars. So you get all the blocks in terms of linear combinations of X and G. So scalar exchange in
four. So do you get derivatives of the scalar blocks, or it's without derivative scalar blocks?
Sorry, I don't hear.
You get derivatives. Sorry, you get
no,
derivatives.
No, they're all done because we understood how the differential operator acts. They're all done. There's nothing to do. So, but what you have to do is find the projection operators and the structures.
Well, I mean, your expressions for general spin on a block. You're saying you're going to write it as some functions of cross ratios multiplying scalar blocks, and nothing is differentiating the scalar block.
You mean the cross ratios times the scalar block?
Well, I mean, you're not in the end taking any derivatives of the scalar blocks.
No, there are no derivatives of the scalar block. Yeah. Okay. So it's just products of cross ratios times the scalar block. And it's a linear combination of that with proper prefactor that depends on whichever. So there are absolutely no derivatives to take anymore. And it works for fermions, it works for, like...
Well, I mean, the statement that... I think you're, like, in my personal opinion, I think you're a bit overemphasizing the fact that you're doing this for general representations, because I don't think this is the hard part. And there are many methods
actually,
of doing
like,
that.
Actually, like, it was hard, so that's why I think it's the hard part. I
mean, yeah, sure. But if your statement is that you can get any... I mean, I know that... We can get, like, we already know that we can get any conformal block as sum of derivatives of scalar block with scalar change.
Yeah.
In end point functions as well. So, as far as I understand, the real result that you have is that you can do this without derivatives in the end.
But it's kind of taking those derivatives and having the result explicitly in just in terms of the scalar exchange in four scalar. So the seed block, if you or another way of saying it, there's only one seed block.
Yes, well, the fact that there is only one seed block, we already know that from reaching
operators, you can
do that. So yeah, I mean, the real result, is, in my understanding, is that you don't have to take derivatives in the end. Do you agree with this assessment, or is there something else?
We don't have to take derivatives, yeah, that's true. But what is also nice is, like, we can package stuff in very nice ways. So, like, the spin L exchange is just given by this. with the proper substitution.
Yes, well, yeah. Weight shifting operators, you can first relate to scalar blocks as Spinel exchange and then use the formula for Spinel scalar exchange.
But my point is like...
I'm just trying to understand what new...
Like if you were to put any representation here, some mess, and you look at what's exchange, it's still going to be like this. So I'll have a linear combination of Gegen bars on which I do substitutions. Okay.
Sorry. But how does the result scale with L? So if I want to compute block for the exchange of a spin 50 operator.
Okay, so that
or generic L, for example.
So like you're thinking more numerical. I actually have no clue how it's going to work. So there is a sum here on this one, and the sum stops at L over 2, like the floor value of L over 2.
So for example, if I want to compute conformal block in a closed form in L,
yeah,
you get an infinite sum.
So it gets bigger. It gets bigger. So if you put 50, then it's 25. So you get 25 terms. But it's worse than that because you know CFT is not easy. So you'll get x to a power 50, I think. That guy is 4 terms. In my definition. So I have to expand that power 50, those 4 terms to the power 50 before I can do the substitution.
Okay. So you have no way to compute a closed form in L.
But I mean, if you want, we have the closed form, but if you want to use it for the numerical bootstrap all the way up to L that big, it might not be easy. That I don't know of. It's probably hard, yeah.
Can you make a step back and instead of expressing everything in terms of exponent g function, express everything in terms of scalar conformal block with spin L, or spin L shifted by something? Also, with all derivatives.
It depends because there are several ways of doing that, and if you want, like there are a bunch of free indices technically for the exchange guys, and. Because it has been hell, for example. But they also have like free indices on those guys. And in the substitution at the end, the way we wrote them now is to like include those free indices in the substitution. So sometimes the substitution is directly like the one for a spinel exchange and for scalars. Other times it's more complicated.
All right, I'm asking because the way we do it in practice is that we use exchange operators to express everything in terms of scalar exchange of scalar conformal block with spin L,
if
and
you
that
want,
is like differential operator. So I'm asking whether you can make this not a differential operator and make this just some function.
I'm not sure. Probably you could, but I'm not sure. If you want from the numerical point of view, I don't think that's that useful because have a lot of machinery already developed to apply. But from an analytic point of view, it's probably good, you know, because we have the answer.
Well, I'm just saying that if you could do it. So if you could relate any block to scalar for external scalars and spin L exchange without using derivatives, that would be useful for numerics.
Yeah, but like one thing I want to point out is it works in any dimensions. So I'm not exactly sure how you guys play with in numerics when you do like 3 dimensions, 5 dimensions, where the blocks are obtained by basically this, if you want, or recurrence relations related to that. So if you were to tell me, like, let's do CFT in 27 dimensions, that would work.
I mean, I can also see it in generalized in 27 dimensions. I don't think this is the conceptually important part, generalizing to D dimensions. There are many methods of doing this.
But, you know, like, the spinner part
All right, let's discuss this after.
Yeah, I guess it's time to have lunch.
Have you tried to derive the weight shifting operators for this embedding space?
Sorry?
Have you tried to derive the weight shifting operators for this general embedding space?
No, we didn't try. So, you know, at first we did look into it and it didn't seem to be what we needed to proceed. We hit a lot of walls when we did that, and at some point, like, that was the best way. At least that's the best way we found. So there might be a better one.